Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. After years of state cutbacks with no relief in sight, OSU President Gordon Gee has said he wants to reconsider the university's assets going into the future. The idea, he says, is to generate revenue for the university's core missions of teaching and learning. Do we need an airport? Do we need a golf course? He asked an audience at the Columbus Metropolitan Club in January. And does the university need to run its own parking operation, or could it be privatized to eliminate the administrative overhead and to generate a pool of fast money? Coming up later, we'll talk more about the larger issue of privatization. First, let's talk about the parking issue. Joining us now is Jeffrey Chattis. He is Senior Vice President for Finance for OSU. He's also the person in charge of the plan to privatize parking. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Good morning.
Question for our listeners. Later on, we'll be talking about privatizations of services at public universities. Do you think that's a good idea if it can generate revenue, or should the university run its own operations? If you have a question about the proposed plan to privatize parking, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org.
And I think this is an important question we have to discuss, but we have to look at the broader context. As you alluded to in your opening comments, the president talked about the need to generate resources going forward, financial resources. We know we're facing tough economic times. You talked about the state cuts, but we also know there's the potential of federal cuts, a significant federal budget deficit that has to be addressed. And I think the context of the parking privatization has to be discussed in that broader financial context. We have needs going forward, and we need to look at all sources of potential funding for the university. So we're looking, for example, at how we purchase things, and can we generate significant resources by focusing on the way we purchase things, looking for new sources of revenue through technology, commercialization, and affiliate relationships. And then finally, there's this question of the assets and should we operate them. And so we're looking at a broad group of them. You mentioned, obviously, parking because that's first, but also we will talk about things like the electric grid, which we currently own and operate at the university. But there's a good need to have that dialogue around should we be owning and operating all of the assets, or can we generate resources to ensure our financial future?
The parking issue is more personal. This is something people deal with every single day when they come to work or they go to school. And it's something that affects them very immediately. They are worried about in terms of their pocketbooks. Ohio State has sent out a request for proposals to private companies interested in managing the campus parking operations. The minimum bid would be $375 million, but OSU is hoping for as much as $400 million, and I've also heard the number $500 million bandied about. The proceeds would be divided among student financial aid, faculty recruitment, the campus bus service, and campus improvements. What is lost in the annual revenue from fees? In other words, the university makes about $30 million a year from the parking. Would the private contractor make that much or more?
Well, let's take a step back and talk about the first part of your question.
Okay.
So anything we do with regards to privatizing assets, we have to start with a couple of principles. The first principle has to be that we will ensure that any increases in the parking costs will be consistent with those increases in the past. So we're not doing this to pass on some kind of windfall profit to another operator or to harm our faculty, staff, or students. So that's the first principle. The second principle is the operator has to operate these facilities at the same level or better than we're currently operating them. So in this example, if we did decide to enter into a concession agreement, if the operator failed to meet our parking standards, we would actually terminate that contract and the operations would revert back to us. So you have to start with that premise that anything we do, whether it's the parking or anything else, is that we're not going to forsake operating standards or have some kind of significant increase in pricing passed on to everybody on campus.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jeff Chattis. He's Senior Vice President of Finance for OSU. We're talking about the proposal to privatize the parking operations on the OSU campus. It's not a done deal yet. The bids are due on May 30th, and President Gee said that only if they get the right bid will they go for it. Let's talk about that first principle that you brought up. Let's talk about the cost. President Gee said that any future parking cost increases will be capped at a rate consistent with a historical average for the past several years. How many years are we talking about? How far back are we going? How many years? Years or 20 years?
So we've looked back as far as 20 years. And, of course, the range of that increase depends on which period you use.
Mm-hmm.
When we started the debate a year ago, we looked at a 10-year period. And in that 10-year period, the increase averaged about 7.5%. If you look at a 12-year period, it's as high as 9%, and if you go 10 years from today, it's somewhere in the 5% range. So we've actually asked the bidders to look at and present bids to us with a 5.5%, 6.5%, and 7.5% increase for 10 years, and then a 4% increase or inflation thereafter. So we've actually tried to make sure that over time that increase is minimized. And then we'll look at those options to compare how would that translate into the amount we receive up front. And by way of an example, and the 7.5% increase in an A permit, which is what our faculty and staff, that's our highest permit, that would be about $6.34 a month. Now, when we talk about those increases, I also want to go back to your other question, which is what would we do with that money and what would it generate? So the notion is not, as I said, that there is a windfall for an operator, but rather that we generate significant resources up front. The president has used the example of $400 million, that we could invest half of that or $200 million in faculty support, so hiring new faculty, $75 million in student scholarships, $50 million in underfunded areas, including the arts and humanities, and then $75 million to improve bus transportation and sustainability on campus. And I think the important thing, though, is that's an example, and that example over the life of the contract would generate about $3.2 billion of reinvestment into the academic core. And at the end of the contract, you'd also have about $4 billion on top of that 3.2, which is in our endowment for the future. So it's all back to this notion of securing our financial future. And remember, we never did sell the parking assets. We owned them the whole time, right, and we keep those. And at the end of the period, we revert the operations back to Ohio State.
Getting back to that second principle in terms of if they don't live up to the terms of the contract, in other words, if they don't provide the standard of service that you call for in the contract will be terminated. How easy is that really going to be? I mean, couldn't this take years of litigation to do something like that?
It's a fairly strict standard, and it comes down actually to a very concrete list of objective standards, which we measure. We will measure each month and along the year. For example, how long does it take for a person to get out if there's a problem with the gate? How many minutes do they have to remove the snow when there's a snowfall? How much paint do they have to apply? And honestly, if they don't do those, there are very clear legal standards that they have the chance to fix them. It's obviously possible that you were going to get into some kind of arbitration or legal process if it's in a gray area. But in general, if they're not meeting those standards, it's fairly clear that we have the option to terminate.
The university has made a commitment to sustainability. I've talked about it before on the show, to reducing the number of cars on the campus and encouraging more walking and biking and mass transportation. But the bottom line, among other things, would be to have a less need for cars, so less need for parking. So what if 20 to 30 years from now that commitment comes to fruition, along with increased fuel prices, which is much more likely, and there is a truly significant drop in the demand for parking? Would the university have the freedom to, for example, demolish a parking garage and create a green space or put up a new building?
You know, it's an interesting point, and actually, if people choose not to drive over time or people stop using cars, I think we've done the best thing possible, right? Because we've generated all these resources up front, and we've shifted that risk to a third party that's not the university. And so in that sense, we've actually done a good thing. But the second part of your question was really, how do we promote sustainability and how do we make sure we have flexibility? Mm-hmm. We have spent a significant amount of time in negotiating the contract to ensure that we can do just what you said. We can move parking to other parts of the university. We can shut things down, that we have the flexibility to run a university. One of the interesting items we discovered as we were doing the contract is that we have about 100 days a year where we have special events, move-in day, commencement, the president visiting, where we need to have flexibility for parking. We've actually, in the contract, increased that to 200 days a year and have said that we have the ability to swap any event we want, because you just can't know for 50 years how things are going to change. So what we've really tried to do is make sure we have as flexible as possible a contract so that as we develop new ideas or new options, we have the ability to implement those.
In a letter signed by more than 90 faculty members at OSU, it said that under the plan, the private contractor would be responsible for maintaining but not improving the service levels. And that's service, of course. What about the parking structures themselves? Is the contractor or the university responsible for maintaining those and improving those?
It's actually the contractor, and they have to deliver them back to us in the same exact shape that we delivered them to them.
But is that necessarily a good thing? I mean, wouldn't you want them, the standards may improve, change over 50 50 years.
Sure.
You want them to be up to standard.
You would, and they have an obligation to invest over time to ensure that those facilities meet the operating standards that we agree to. So that would imply that they actually do have to continue to invest in those facilities to not just maintain but improve service.
Some folks are concerned that the companies bidding on the garage management are not only from out of state, but some are from out of the country. And they're troubled that the revenue from the deal will be leaving the state and concerned that there won't be the same sense of commitment to the university and to the people it serves. Why not limit this contract to in-state contractors only?
There are actually two pieces to that question, Ann. So the first is the financial bidder, and they are global. Some are from the United States. Some are from Australia, actually. Some were from Canada, but each one of those has partnered with an American parking operator, some of whom operate in Central Ohio today. So when we actually get the bids in, each of them actually have an American operator, and it's our view that, interestingly, we are actually bringing capital and jobs to Ohio. So actually, if it's a foreign bidder that's the financial partner, they'll be opening an office in Columbus. They'll be employing people in the state of Ohio. And, of course, the operators who are all American, most of them either operate currently in Ohio or plan to add operations in Ohio. So it's important to recognize Ohio State's a global institution. We have an endowment that invests globally, that we do research globally. We have gateways across the world. And so it's really important to remember that this is just a manifestation of the nature of the global institution.
President Gia said that no current transportation and parking employee would lose his or her job from a new contract. So is that a guaranteed in the contract? And does that mean that they could lose their state employee status and probably be paid less?
We have said from day one that our staff will continue to have a job at Ohio State.
How can you make a promise like that?
Well, it's just a clear promise. We've said very clearly that anybody who wants to have a job at Ohio State that is currently in the parking operation will continue to do so. And I think it's really important that the focus isn't just on the jobs, but it really is what this is all about. And I met yesterday with a student, John, who's a first-generation student from Cleveland. And when we were talking about his experience here as a student leader, he said to me, "Jeff, I'm just thankful that I was able to leave with only $20,000 in debt." And I think that's kind of an amazing statement, and it's our responsibility as leaders and administrators to look creatively at a number of sources of funding, because we need to make sure that we are able to say, "No, John, it's not $20,000. It's much less debt that you need to have when you come to Ohio State." And I think you know that the first fruits of our financial strategy are coming to bear, that last month we announced that we are committing an additional $50 million to scholarships, and that we're going to be able to increase the financial aid to our neediest students by about $1,000 per student next year, and that this is actually part of that broader discussion.
When you talk about $50 million to financial aid, is that $50 million cash, or is that an investment of $50 million and then the like an endowment and the proceeds from that will go to financial aid?
That's cash, and that first piece of investment into financial aid is actually coming from our cost savings that we're going to generate about $27 million this year from just getting folks on campus to standardize the use of copier servicing and overnight shipping. It's hard to believe, but that's going to generate about $27 million. And from the revenue we're generating from our new affinity relationship. So we'll actually be able to put that current cash right into what's most important, which is funding financial aid.
In a column in the Dispatch last week, a member of the University Senate at OSU said that the agreement asks for OSU to lobby against laws that could hurt the revenue stream of the operation and list adverse action events that would trigger compensation by the university. Because those events had reduced the operator's revenue. Can you explain? I know there's two issues there. What about the idea of OSU lobbying against laws?
Well, the contract is fairly clear that we do have to be careful. We can promote, which we've been very clear, and we will continue to promote ideas of sustainability and working with our students and faculty, things like the COTA bus pass, encouraging people to ride to work. We can do any of that. The technical language you're referring to is really we have entered into an agreement with an operator, and we can't go out to intentionally harm that operator. So I think that's important to distinguish between that notion, intentional harm, and the broader notion, which is this is a partnership with an operator. They're going to be here for a long time, and we need to work together and make sure we have flexibility, but that they've made a sensible investment for themselves.
Okay, Jeff Chattis, thanks so much for joining us today.
Our pleasure.
Jeff Chattis. He's Senior Vice President of Finance for OSU. He's been managing the deal around the parking contract. The bids go out. Our bids should be in by May 30th, and they'll make a decision after that. Coming up, Jim Petro. He is Chancellor of the Ohio Board of Regents. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
You can listen to 89.7 NPR News anytime by streaming on the web. Just visit WOSU.org and click on the Listen Now button at the top of the page. Listen to local and national news from your computer or mobile device. Just visit WOSU.org.
Support for 89.7 comes from Montgomery & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, offering perspective in a time of economic uncertainty to help grow and maintain wealth. Details at themontgomerysolution.com.
72 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today, a high of 76. Clear skies for tonight, a low of 44 degrees. Sunshine for Thursday, and a high of 77. Clear skies Thursday night, and a low of 50. And more sunshine as we look ahead to Friday with a high of 80. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
So what does it mean to privatize operations at a public university? Joining us now to talk about that is Jim Petro. He's Chancellor of the Ohio Board of Regents. Welcome to the show, Jim Petro.
Hi, it's good to be with you, Ann, as always.
I guess first we have to decide and agree on what is a public university anymore. A very small percentage of revenue for Ohio State comes from the public anymore.
And it's remarkable. Ohio State and the other universities obviously have more and more opportunity and more obligation to kind of derive their own revenues. The state support has declined. There's no question. It declined, frankly, over the last 5 years, not so much under Governor Kasich. I mean, Governor Kasich really did what he could in this budget to maintain the best we could in view of the loss of federal funds that were one-time federal funds that literally financed the last 2 years of the last administration's budget for higher ed.
But the questions about the expense of higher education, they go back to when you and I were both in the State House, you as a state representative and me,
sure,
you know, and me covering it. The culture of questions about what a state university should be doing and how it should be generating its revenue have been around a long time now.
It has been. And, you know, even from my perspective, I do encourage creativity on the part of the universities. There's no question about that, because I think they need to be innovators. And I also think they need to be watching their overhead. I did a speech the other night, and I made no bones about it. We do have too many programs. Maybe you remember, in 2005, I spoke at the Metropolitan Club, and I talked about strictly higher ed. It was the Attorney General with my observations at the time about higher ed in Ohio. And I said, we duplicate too much. Too many programs at too many universities are duplicative, and we need to understand that that's going to drive up cost. I made the same statement the other day because it remains true. We need to find ways to drive down overhead, and that means that every university can't be all things to all students. Also, my big objective and what I'm really focused on is completion of degrees. Probably less than half of those who start at one of our public colleges or public universities really never finish. They never get a degree. And that becomes a waste of our money. If somebody has 5 semesters of college and they, you know, what does that mean? They can't put it on their resume. It might have been intellectually nice, but it doesn't mean a thing in terms of economic value. And we need to get more and more completion. To get completion, we need to drive down cost. To drive down cost, we need to have fewer programs. Plus, one more thing, and that is one of the things that discourages students is too much time to degree, and they eventually drop away, or too much choice. Sometimes students have too many choices. They can't think of what they want to major in, so they ultimately drift away from the objective of getting a completed degree. Go ahead now.
Okay.
I'm done.
The completion issue, you talked about that in relationship to too many choices, too much duplication. But for a lot of students, particularly non-traditional students, which are a growing number in the public school,
about 75% of
the choice
students,
isn't about some kind of, you know, frivolous, I want to take pottery class, nothing against potters, but it's about, I need more options because I work full time.
Yes.
You know, if you want to get an engineering degree, I mean, I'm not sure if it's exactly the case right now, but at say at Ohio State, if you work full time, you can't do that.
Well, one of the things, and you know, we have been, we're actually completing a whole array of strategic initiatives, plus we're talking broadly with universities as part of our completion task force, talking broadly about initiatives, excuse me, that's going to, you know, help people who are working, who have a family to take care of, with a schedule that's more attuned to the working student or the family student. We call it block scheduling, but it might mean, for example, at a community college, an 18-month program where a student who's working can go every day, will go every day, required, it's like a job, from 4 to 7 every day. That means they can go after their work hours, go to school 5 days a week for 18 continuous months, no summer vacation, no time off, and at the end of that time, they will have completed all of the courses necessary for an associate degree. That's the kind of scheduling we need to be doing, and that's part of our advocacy here at the Board of Regents on things that the universities need to be looking at. At the university level, you know, for the second 2 year, for the second block of 2 years at a university, the leading up to their baccalaureate degree, I'm starting to recommend that they look at block scheduling for people within their major area of study, so that they can then do an internship or a co-op in the afternoons. And that means they're going to get an early jump on the job needs that they're going to have for the future.
Jim Pietro, if state or public universities and colleges continue in the direction they're going, which is decreased public funding, increasing their endowments, ideally, but raising money wherever they can, maybe by privatizing their parking operations like OSU is looking to do, at what point do they cease to become public? At what point could someone make the argument, Jim Pietro, you can't have any say over what we do anymore because we're not obligated to the state anymore?
Well, first of all, the state is still state property. It is still a state asset. But the day could come, and I don't think it will. I mean, even this administration and certainly this Board of Regents office, we're advocating a continuation of the support that is currently out there that we're giving to the universities, and I think we're providing still significant support. The state share of instruction that is distributed to our public universities is nearly $2 billion a year. So it's not like it's chicken feed. It's a significant amount of public funds that are really going to our public schools and public universities.
But, you know, that's a chicken feed compared to the endowment that Harvard University has.
Well, and I understand that. Well, yes, but even Harvard, they kind of hoard their own money, and they still charge you $55,000 a year
right,
to go there. You know, our public universities are developing all kinds of ways to make it easier and more cost-effective for students. One of the great programs here in Columbus is the Preferred Pathway. At Columbus State, where you can go for your first 2 years for about $3,500 a year, you can sign up for what they call the Preferred Pathway, and at the completion of your associate degree, you can transfer directly to Ohio State, get full credit for your first 2 years, and 2 years later have a baccalaureate degree from one of the most prestigious universities in the country. We have things like that that are evolving that recognize the cost implications of getting a college degree.
My guest is Jim Pietro. He's chancellor of the Ohio Board of Regents. We're talking about privatization and ancillary issues of public education, public higher education in the state of Ohio. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Different institutions define their core mission differently.
Yes.
For example, OSU President Gordon Gia said that the dormitories are part of the core mission because they can influence a student's academics and social experience so much at OSU. That's why he wants to expand the dormitory requirement to sophomores, but some public universities in other states are turning to private sector to build and finance on-campus dormitories and effectively renting them from the developers. And I was wondering if that's happening anywhere in Ohio and whether or not those kinds of changes are a concern to you.
That kind of change doesn't bother me a bit, and I know that elsewhere on campuses, public campuses in Ohio, they're looking at that. In fact, they're looking at that as an option at some of our community colleges where more and more students are traveling 50 or 60 miles and are looking for housing near one of our major community colleges, so or some of the branch campuses. And so that concept of private financing of dormitories and a contract that then is engaged with the university so that they build it, and then the students pay the essentially the board charge, or the room charge, rather. You know, that's not that unusual, because even when a university builds a dormitory, it is not something that goes against the university's revenues for other purposes. It is not a non-education purpose, and the business side of building a dormitory for a university is one where they finance the dormitory, usually with bond debt financing, and then that bond debt is paid for by the students, you know, room charge. So it becomes kind of a, even where the university does it, it's generally a quasi-private enterprise type gesture. It really is not part of the education budget.
In some states where the universities have been doing this, the price to live in those dormitories is higher.
Mm-hmm.
It starts to kind of separate students from one another, doesn't it?
When you say separate students from one another,
the ones who can afford it and the ones who can't.
I think that's probably the case. I like the idea of students, you know, actually. I'm not weighing in on the sophomores having to live on campus, but I do weigh in on the notion that students engaged in a lot of communicative activity with one another, living, you know, collectively in apartments or dorms, where they're actually engaged with one another, is really part of the learning process at any college or university. So I hope there's actually more of that, and that living with cohorts that can encourage one another can also drive completion. You know, the student who is kind of a loner and doesn't have that cohort experience working with other students, they're less likely to finish college. And so, again, we're looking at ways in every way possible and encouraging those ways to get kids to complete college and get a degree. Ohio is an under-degreed state. I'll tell you the statistic, Ann, that knocks me over. 30 years ago, America was number one in the world in attainment of post-secondary degrees. Now we're number 15. Now, that has not helped nationally our economic activity. And let me tell you, in Ohio, where we're in the bottom quarter of the states in terms of attainment of a baccalaureate degree, that has not helped Ohio.
What do you attribute that to? What do you know about the causes of such a precipitous decline?
In many ways, Ohio has been a manufacturing state where people didn't necessarily think they needed to get a degree. The lesson of today and the lesson of today's economy, and we see a governor who understands this. I mean, the business development that he's encouraging really requires more than just a high school diploma. In fact, I don't think it's unfair for me to say that the jobs of tomorrow clearly demand at least something more than a high school diploma, something post-secondary. We're developing an array of new certificate programs that really will provide the underlying training over 1 year, for example, after high school diploma is received, for somebody who's going to work almost in any manufacturing enterprise, because technology today really requires additional training beyond high school. And everything in the manufacturing side is driven by new technology. So everything is changing, and we need to move ahead of the curve to really have the kind of economic growth that Ohio needs.
You need to educate people so that they can get jobs. But what about that other part of the higher education experience for a lot of people, that liberal arts part of it, where you're rounding yourself out and you're learning about things like philosophy, like cultural history, sociology, as those, the demand for those things and that kind of education decreases in the job market, by privatizing and going and looking at the bottom line only, don't we run risk of losing that and also the pure science and the pure questioning?
I don't think we will. I mean, there always has to be advocacy for pure learning. I mean, I have a history degree, and then subsequent to that, I have a law degree. But I guess the point is, I treasure the notion of a liberal arts background. I enjoy my reading. I enjoy the study of history. I still do. I did when I was in college. If we start moving to pure job training type formats, I do agree with you. We're going to lose something along the way. But I don't think universities are turning away from education that is mind expanding and broadening, you know, in a greater sense. And there's a lot of employers who understand the importance of a liberal arts education. I mean, I hear all the time about employers who, at one point, their sales force, because they're a manufacturing firm and they have a sales force in the field, they were hiring people with engineering backgrounds. Now they might be hiring people with liberal arts backgrounds because their communication skills are different and can be particularly valuable in the selling format that they're engaged in. I guess the point I'm making is that education for education's sake remains very important also, and broadening, you know, the skills and, you know, the overall learning of all of our people, I think, is going to have an important impact on Ohio.
Besides the completion idea, how much is the university system investing in helping graduates understand what it takes to work in the job market and get a job? It seems there's this big drop off. You've got your degree in hand, and that's it. They don't even know how to look for a job.
I don't disagree. I think we need more guidance and we need more career direction, not only in universities, but in our high schools. We're involved, Stan Hefner and I, and one of the things I'm very proud of in my work as chancellor is that I become very, very collaborative with the superintendent of public instruction, which
Stan
is something
Hefner,
new.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And Stan and I work together on a whole variety of things. We are the Ohio representatives in a national consortia called PARC, which is developing an assessment which will commence, we hope, in 2014, that'll be for all of our 10th, 11th, 12th graders that will assess their college readiness and develop a remediation plan where they're not college ready, but also give them opportunities for greater career readiness, even if they're not necessarily going to be someone who go on to a four-year college program or even a two-year college program. Career readiness, as I say, can come with a one-year certificate program. But in every instance, I think true career readiness in Ohio and in, you know, the economy of the future really demands something beyond high school. There's got to be some post-secondary training.
About 1,000 people, students and faculty and staff, are to gather today and tomorrow on the South Oval at Ohio State to talk about what would happen if they had more say in how the university is run. Some folks would say that that's why you have a board of trustees and the university administration and so forth. But what are your thoughts about faculty, staff, and student participation in governing a public institution like Ohio State or anyone in the
well,
state?
You know, obviously, from an operational standpoint, the professionals, and I know you had Jeff Chattis on, and he is a professional.
Mm-hmm.
You've got your finance professionals, you've got your management professionals, and they've got to be managing the assets of the universities. But they also have to understand that part of their team is the instruction and the quality of instruction and their ability to attract the quality of instructors that every university needs as part of its reputation as a teaching institution. That's an important part of the team. And then beyond that, then they have to attract and they have to work with their customers. And their customers are the students. When I picked a college, and when I picked a law school, I was the guy paying the money to get the degree, and I always thought, well, I've got to have some input in this process. And so I don't discourage that. I mean, in the same way that the customers of laundry soap, you know, really have some significant impact on the operational decisions made by P&G or Lever Brothers or one of those, you know, the universities have to be attentive to their faculty because that's the strength of the university. Its reputation is the quality of the faculty. And, of course, at the same time, the students and the quality of students that they're able to attract, they're the customers.
Jim Pietro, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, Ann. It's always good to be with you. Thank you.
Jim Pietro, he's chancellor of the Ohio Board of Regents. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation about privatizing the parking operations at Ohio State University, and also the larger question of privatizing operations at universities that are supposed to be public. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Many 89.7 NPR News members have discovered the advantages of using the WOSU member card for two-for-one dining, cultural events, and family activities. The member card benefit of the month for May is the Gateway Film Center. Enjoy two-for-one admission all month long. Become a basic $60 member and get your member card by going to WOSU.org now. Thank you for supporting 89.7 NPR News.
And this is 89.7 NPR News. Stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of All Sides, and a discussion of long-term brain injuries for football players. Join us for that discussion from 11 till noon. 72 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today and a high of 76. Clear skies for tonight and a low of 44 degrees. Sunshine for Thursday, a high of 73, clear skies Thursday night and a low of 49. Another nice day for Friday, more sunshine and a high of 80. WOSU Public Media presents the Chefs in the City online auction. You can bid now on fabulous Chefs in the City culinary theme packages. New items are constantly being added, and items close on a weekly basis. So bid early and often, and bid high to buy. All proceeds benefit children's educational programming on WOSU. Visit WOSU.org/chefs to view all items up for bid. And All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Ohio State University has sent out a request for proposals to private companies interested in managing campus parking operations. The minimum bid would be $375 million, but OSU is hoping for as much as $400 million. The proceeds would be divided among student financial aid, faculty recruitment, the campus bus service, and campus improvements, among other things. The bids are due on May 30th. Joining us now to talk about the concerns of many in the university community about the parking plan and about privatization of the university operations in general is Gordon Albrecht. He's an OSU physics professor and president of the OSU chapter of the American Association of University Professors. Welcome to the show, Gordon.
Thank you, Ann. It's good to be here.
So OSU president Gordon Gee has said the idea behind the privatization of the parking operations is to generate revenue. Are you opposed to privatization in general or this contract in particular?
I guess I would have to say both. And I will tell you Let me tell you why I'm opposed to this particular one.
Okay.
First of all, it's been said that parking is not central to the university mission, but I believe that it is. We have to have students who attend our classes. We have to have staff who run the university. We have to have faculty to do the research and meet with the students. And how do you do that in today's world? Unfortunately, we don't all live right next to campus. We can't walk. We can't bike, all of us anyway. And the only way that most students, faculty, and staff can get to campus is parking. The university would not run if they couldn't get there to do the parking. So that's the first point I'd like to make.
Mm-hmm.
Second is that the investors who are going to get the parking lease will be able to depreciate buildings they didn't pay for. Ohio taxpayers paid for them, and OSU is going to continue to pay for the loans to build those parking structures. And also, some finance professors, I didn't listen to the earlier thing, so I don't know if Vice President Chattis mentioned this, but there were finance professors who did a study. Their study was incomplete, but they said that the present value of the parking facilities is at least $600 million. And I did a calculation. According to my calculation, OSU would need to net $1 billion in order to be able to break even over 50 years. And the reason for that is that if they get $375 to $400 million, the amount of interest for that, if it were all put into the endowment, would be about the amount of money that the fees that the faculty, staff, and students pay for parking right now go to support the bus service, the traffic lights, maybe even campus police. I'm not certain about that last point. But anyway, that totals about $17 million a year. And at what the endowment pays, if the entire thing were put into the endowment, that would be about yearly $17 million a year. In other words, there would be no net benefit to the university. Right now, traffic and parking pays $1.7 million a year into the Office of Academic Affairs as a tax. Every unit pays a little tax. So they're paying that. That would not be there anymore. The expenses would still be there. In fact, if the parking is moved off to West Campus, according to the master plan's vision, that would increase the need for bus service and increase the cost of that. And so it seems to me that for all of these reasons, and I obviously have more, but for these three basic reasons, I think that it is a bad idea. It's a short-term response to a long-term problem. And if we are really going to be able to get money out of parking, why doesn't the university get the money instead of giving it away to private investors?
So is this that you don't like the deal then?
There are a lot of things I don't like. One of the things that I don't like is that the faculty are supposed to be part of the governance of the university, and they were essentially blocked from considering this before it was taken to the Board of Trustees. I wrote a letter to the chair of the Board of Trustees at their meeting in September, early September, between the end of summer quarter and the beginning of fall quarter, asking them to put off a vote until the Senate would have a chance to discuss this, because we do have a university Senate, and the university Senate gives advice to the Board of Trustees. I think that it would have been a good idea to have had a discussion with the university Senate, which represents the faculty, the administration, and the students, before the Board of Trustees took this action.
My guest is Gordon Albrecht. He's OSU physics professor and president of the OSU chapter of the American Association of University Professors. We're talking about privatization at the public universities and specifically the privatization of parking at Ohio State University. Steve in the North End, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Good morning. I think the contract should be sold to two companies. So Company A could compete with Company B on prices and services instead of one company having a monopoly.
Well, I guess the idea is they're putting it the minimum at $375 million because they figured that that's the minimum that a company would find it worth it, Steve, to do it.
But why couldn't it be broken down into two parking companies run it, and that way they could compete with each other to give the best service to the students and the faculty?
Okay. Thanks, Steve.
That's all I got.
Yeah, thank you. Gordon?
Yes.
Any thoughts about that?
Not really. Okay. I think that it's a bad idea in any case because it's transferring profit from Ohio taxpayers to individuals. We built these parking garages. This is public money that is being given as a gift to private investors and for short-term means to get this $375 or $400 million. And in the long term, it's going to cost the university unless they get $1 billion, which I don't see that being in the cards. I'm not the only one who's done a calculation like this. Bruce Whitey, who is on the ad hoc committee that is advising Vice President Chattis, did a calculation. He came up with around $800 million, which is in the same ballpark, in order for us to be able to fund the bus service, fund the traffic lights, do the kinds of things that the president says he wants to do with this money. They've spent it so many different ways, and there just isn't enough money unless you have $1 billion, really, or $800 million, if you believe Professor Whitey, to spend for this. It is not what they say it is. And, of course, they have Morgan Stanley as their advisor, and Morgan Stanley doesn't get paid unless there is a lease that's signed, and Morgan Stanley has an interest in lowballing the figure in order to make sure that there is a lease and that it is in excess of what they said the value was. And as I said, the finance professors say the present value of just the parking facilities, not any of these other things like bus service, et cetera, is $600 million.
What about ideas about leasing or leasing the operations of the golf course and the airport and those kinds of things?
Well, I understand that there is opposition in Arlington to getting rid of the golf course, but I don't see golf as central to the work of the university. And I don't see the airport as something that the university has to have in order to have an aviation center. Parking is something that the university has to have in order for faculty to be there to teach the students, for students to get there, to be in the presence of our outstanding faculty, and for staff to be there, and they're the people who run the university. And, you know, I've talked to quite a lot of staff people. I have not yet found one who is in support of parking privatization, but of course no one will say anything for attribution because they're afraid that somebody's going to take it out on them if they hear them say these things.
Well, about 1,000 people are going to gather today and tomorrow on the South Oval to talk about what would happen if they had more say in how the university is run.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks like they're going to come out and go public
with
that.
I really think the big problem is a change in priorities in the state of Ohio and in other places in the world, in the United States. We used to be a leader in degrees, college degrees, and we are now, I don't know, ranked in the second tier, the second 10 group,
yeah,
or something
Chancellor
like that.
Yeah, Chancellor Petro was just talking about
and,
that, too.
And the reason is that we once had a system in many states of this country where the cost of an education was bearable. In fact, Cliff Hare, who was a colleague of mine, he's now deceased, I once asked him, he attended Ohio State as an undergraduate, as a graduate student, and he actually became a faculty member. And I said, well, when you got back home after World War II, you went to Ohio State, right? And he said, yes. And I said, well, what was your tuition? He said, well, we didn't have any tuition. We paid $10 a quarter student fees. And he and his wife lived in campus housing, and he was able on the GI Bill to attend the university. And this man has something like 50 patents in inertial navigation systems. He was an asset to the country. They're using it for the military and so on. They did this. It's an asset to the state of Ohio. It was something that the citizens of Ohio thought was a really good investment to do, and that was true in other states as well.
There's a lot of questioning of the value of a college education now, though.
Yes, I can see that, and I don't think that necessarily every person in the country has to go to college in order to have a fulfilling life. But I do think that college does add a whole lot of stuff. I have a Bachelor of Arts degree because I'm really a proponent of a liberal education. So I took a lot of math and physics when I was in college, but I made sure that I took those English courses and the other kinds of courses that gave me a broad view of life, of scholarly knowledge, and of things like that. And I think that is really valuable. People who have an English degree don't get hired to write letters. They get hired to think. Mm-hmm. We want to have people who can think critically. And one of the things that we all want to do as professors at Ohio State is to help our students become critical thinkers if they're not already. And many of them are not. So we our value added is to help make critical thinkers out of people who don't think critically about things, who don't understand how data can be used to fix a theory and how theories work in science and so forth. All of these things are things that people learn at a university or can learn at a university. And I think that that's a really valuable thing. And we have really great faculty here at Ohio State. My department is a great department. It's highly ranked in the country, but we have lots of other departments that are highly ranked in the country, and this is a wonderful university.
Let's hear from one of those students, Nicholas, on the South Oval at OSU. Welcome to the show, Nicholas.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thank you.
I've actually met with Gordon a number of times. I'm a student here at OSU.
Gordon on the phone, Gordon Norbeck?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Hi, how you doing, Gordon?
Hi, Nick.
Hi. So we're gathering here on the South Oval for, you know, issues that are exactly, you know, of this nature. We see, the university as being governed as, being very top down. It's like basically, 15 board trustees that make the decisions for, roughly 100,000 students, faculty, and staff that actually comprise this university, or the lifeblood of this university. I pay tuition into this university, and I personally have you know, no actual accountable say on, you know, matters such as this. And with the parking lot issue, I think it's, you know, it's preposterous because, you know, you have around 85% of faculty that have been polled who are opposed to the measure, but you have, you know, us pursuing the measure regardless. A kind of related issue that my student organization, I'm actually president of an organization called United Students Against Sweatshops, and basically our university has been looking into getting a single source licensee, basically monopoly contract with Dallas Cowboys Merchandising to run our apparel industry, putting us at a dependence on sweatshop labor. And with the same kind of pattern we're seeing is that this is decisions that are being made behind closed doors. They're not including faculty, staff, and students in the measure. And
Well, I guess one of the bottom lines is that public funding for higher education in the state of Ohio and across the country is shrinking, and the university has to make up the shrinkage.
I mean, I think our public fund, the amount of funds we get from the state is something around like 7 to 10%,
at most.
Yeah, it's pretty terrible as well. But I think there was actually an article in The Lantern recently talking about the bonuses that have been awarded to a number of.
But long term, I mean, the bonuses and that's a point. But long term, and Nicholas, thanks for calling. Gordon Albrecht, long term, what is the university supposed to do?
Well, it is definitely a difficult position for the university to be in. There's no question about it. Not just this university, but most of the state universities in the country are in a similar position. As I said earlier in time, the state of Ohio thought that it was really valuable to have an educated workforce, and they were able to support the university mm-hmm. in the way it needed to be supported to produce educated Ohioans. I think that those days are probably never going to come back, and that, in a sense, that's too bad. But anyway, the important thing to think about is whether the short-term benefit of getting $375 or $400 million offsets the long-term losses to the university. I think that is an important point that people don't talk about, and also the fact that there are things that the parking passes pay for that support all kinds of other aspects of university life. As I mentioned, mm-hmm. money that goes into the central administration, right. Money that pays for the campus bus service, that's all paid for by the people who use the parking services. Those funds will have to come from somewhere if the parking is leased. And the interest on $375 million, if all of it's put in, is only going to cover that. It's going to be a zero-sum game. They're not going to gain anything from that.
Gordon, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're running out of time now.
Okay.
So I want to thank you, though, for joining us, Gordon Albrecht, OSU physics professor and president of the OSU chapter of the American Association of University Professors. Thank you very much for joining us.
And thank you for listening to me, Ann.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. Thank you for listening. It's All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.